The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Paul Hill, full-time everything. Equity analyst, investor, he's full on, from full stop. He goes to bed and for a couple of hours, wakes back up and he's full on again. You're right, Paul, how's things?
Yeah, long time no speak, Justin. We haven't touched base, have we, for about 3 or 4 weeks. It's been the summer holiday. I've had a couple of weeks, a bit of downtime. You were away, obviously, in Wales last week. And so there's been quite a bit happening. But I think the next sort of September anyway, is going to be really busy. So we'll that'll keep us on our toes.
Yeah, I remind people, if you're listening on the podcast and you want to see our pretty faces, you can do. So it's on video as well. And I had a shave especially, but I didn't shave the top of my head. I walked into my apple tree. We had an apple tree at the back garden and we've trimmed it a bit. And there's a spike in the back of my head and cut my head. I got attacked by an apple tree. Can't believe that. Assault by apple. But so I'm seeing the top of my head if you want to see that on video. But yeah, catch us on the YouTube channel and hit that subscribe and like button. First of all, what do you want to talk about? Because I know it's one of your stocks.
I've actually been doing a bit of sort of like portfolio, sort of like moving around a bit. And as you know, I own quite a bit. My portfolio is quite exposed to sort of the UK house building market. I mean, I've obviously owned Lloyds. I've got Grainger, who are a private landlord. I've got Alico, who are the software boys, which go into sort of infrastructure and stuff like that. And therefore, they've all done pretty well. And it would just be becoming too big an exposure. So I've decided actually a couple of weeks ago to sell my Taylor Wimpey shares, which was a full position and done really well. I bought at the middle of last year, and it obviously was had crashed at that point. So I've made a nice return, and I've split it into two new positions. But I would just like to say, you know, the reason why I sold it is an exposure, just a bit of portfolio construction management. I've got no problem with Taylor Wimpey. I think it will do well. It's round about fairly valued at current levels, about 1.5 times book. But given the government is now starting to raise taxes, there is a chance that it uses the housing market as a bit of an ATM to raise more cash, as it obviously has done with its national insurance last week. And likewise, because the supply chains around the world and in the UK are so tight, there is again a chance that, you know, the house builders, because they have these large sites, they're relying on the supply of multiple different, product providers. And there is a chance that some of those are on the critical path, whether that's plasterboard, cement, whatever it is, and therefore may delay the completion of certain sites. Or alternatively, you know, they're something like a house builder, and I don't think Taylor Wimpey would do it, but certainly has, but they basically swap out and substitute what they can't get with an inferior quality product. And if they do that, then they potentially get quality issues. So I really don't think that will happen, but it's a potential risk out there. And that's because I was overexposed to it. I thought, right, okay, let's bank a bit of profit and let's split it down. That was about 8% position. So I've bought now two new positions.
Do you know what? Let me just say one thing. I love that. That's why you're an equity analyst. The analysis you gave, because often, you know, I have people ask me, so how do you know when to sell a stock? And essentially, it does take a lot of time, doesn't it? Because if you hold quite a few stocks you're happy with, you've got to look at, you know, what's going to be impacted more, what are you going to get more return from? And you're right there. It's very complex house building, you know, and there's so many supply chains going into it and all that stuff. Mm. And do you know what's fascinating? House prices are still growing, of course, but the growth has slowed down a little bit. I don't know if you saw that. It was 7.6% growth year into last month or July, then till August, 7.1%. And I don't know anything about houses a lot, really, but I'm on all the on the markets app and all that, and Rightmove and Zoopla, and I've noticed more properties coming to market and more being reduced in price, whereas that wasn't happening. It was almost, I checked one point to see if I was still registered for the apps, because there was no one selling or the prices were massively inflated. But now it's new stock coming on, I've seen, and some of them have been reduced as well. So it's very interesting. I don't know how that plays.
I don't think it's a demand problem. I think the demand's going to carry on, you know, particularly on the sort of premium buildings. I think
Lloyds are going to houses as well, aren't they?
Sorry?
Lloyd's are going into houses and rentals now.
Yeah, yeah, well, exactly, yeah. I mean, Lloyd's is a slightly different situation, I think. It's more of a macro play. But certainly in terms of the housing market, I think demand is going to be fine. The problem is supply. And it's not only sort of like, you know, there's lots of moving parts there. It's not only the actual product itself. It's labour, yeah. It's HGV drivers. It's the whole lot. And you could actually find, you know, that industry, like the auto industry, just struggles to complete its actual sites or does get overly aggressive and use substitute material and the build quality goes down. So I don't think that will happen with Taylor Wimpey. I think it will do well. And if I could hold it, I would hold it. But as I say, my portfolio is pretty damn exposed anyway to that whole ecosystem. And I just wanted to sort of take it down as much, just in case there had been. If the government suddenly said, right, okay, I'm going to tax the, when we give building permissions to land, I'm going to tax that uplift in the actual, you know, from unpermissioned land to actual granted land to be able to build.
Why do you think that? Has it been rumoured?
It's been talked about for some time that they could tax that. So there's a whole bunch of different things they could tax, and super profits and all that kind of. I don't think that will happen. They won't want to do that to damage the economy. But anyway, it was just something I wanted to.
Let's hear the big sales. Come on, big sales. The ones you bought. Let's have the big sale.
No, that's the big sale, right? Okay, that's the one. But the actual ones are.
No, I mean the big sale on the new ones. Yeah, go on.
Okay, yeah. Well, I've split the funds in two positions. First of all, and I've talked about it before because I've liked it, is Amrit Pharma. And the reason why I think it's good is that they've just bought this business, Chiasma, out in the States, and it's been an all-equity deal. 60% is going to be owned by Amra shareholders and 40% Chiasma. And they bring two very good, a new drug which treats acromegaly, which is basically sort of like somebody, you know, if you've got a hormone deficiency, you then start to, or growth deficiency, you then sort of have your hands and your feet and your head gets a bit bigger than it should do. And what they have developed is the first tablet to be able to treat that. And that's important for hospitals because currently the best in class treatment is having to actually inject it or intravenous, and that will take up a lot of hospital time. So having this tablet should do, you know, really well. I mean, the whole thing about the investment thesis really for Amrit Pharma, it's a buy and build rare disease sort of orphan drug type company. And while I like that is it hits small patient populations. And the reason why that is really interesting is that as we move towards personalized medicine, then and obviously genomic sequencing of people, that's going to become far more common. And what's also good about sort of like rare diseases is that big pharma have ignored it for years and years because it hasn't got a total addressable market sufficient to warrant all the upfront R&D. And so what that means is that one, they're competing against people who are, you know, effectively isn't quite as competitive, but also you find the standard of care doesn't exist. It's basically a placebo because there's no treatment out there. And so what they've got is basically you've got therapeutics and drugs coming on, which are essentially they're best in class because there's nothing out there. And what this is the treatment they've just bought from Chiasma is their third treatment. They've already got one which does their lead drug does where they treat hormone deficiency. That where you get people who get overweight for it, and that's doing very well. It's growing at about 10% per annum. And they have another one which treats bad cholesterol, which is growing in sort of the low single digits. So overall, the business should go at the underlying high single digits. It's growing faster than that because it had a large Latin America contracted one at the time. So that's the three sort of drugs. And also what Chiasma bring, which is important to investors, is actually a bit of a platform play because it has the technology to be able to convert existing orphan or rare disease drugs that are used for, have to be injected or intravenous, to convert that into tablets. And there should be a whole pipeline of that. So that's another potential growth. And likewise, one of their other drugs, one of those drugs, and I can't remember which one it is, I think it's the it's the one which is coming from Chiasma. It's got another big, you know, potential market opportunity as well. So, you know, that's good. And then most people have probably remember, you know, that they've actually got this oleo gel, which treats a condition that is for sort of a very rare one, sort of like for newborn babies and young children who get blistering of the skin. They haven't actually got sufficient protein. And this causes lots of scarring tissue, wounds and stuff like that. And as I say, there's just nothing out there that can possibly, that helps. It's basically just put some cream on it. Anyway, this treatment they have has gone through phase three trials. It met its primary endpoint to treat severe cases of this, and it's about a 70% or odd percent improvement in actual treatment regime. And that's so good that the FDA has sort of fast tracked it through the approval process and given it orphan drug status. And they're coming to make a final decision on that drug, whether it can go to market. I think it's on the 30th November.
Yeah, 30th November. Yeah.
And they're hoping then to be able to launch that in the US immediately. And they believe the take up will be really strong because there's nothing else out there. And then launch it in the US, in Europe in quarter one. And that could be a $1 billion market. And when you put all that together, and you do, you know, some of the parts of the actual business, the shares are currently trading at about 165p. Mm-hmm. If I look at the three drugs they've currently got, with the one we've got from Chiasma and the two existing ones, I cannot get less than a share price of £2.40. And that's assuming a $300 million turnover. And they're currently saying without the Chiasma that they're going to do 215, I think it is, this year. So, you know, it looks pretty reasonable. And so if you get a £2.40 just for the existing business, what you then get for free and even a negative value is your oleo gel, which is just basically, you know, the only game in town. And you also get the rest of the pipeline and the other, you know, the IP in there. So I actually think this could be, and if you just do the oleo gel, I reckon that's another worth £1.40. So that comes to £4. You put in the rest of the pipeline and the other stuff, we've probably got another quid in there. I could easily see these over the next 4 years going to £5. So I've got a reasonable position. It's a 4%, just over 4% position, but I'm happy to add to that. They've got a capital markets day on Monday, which I'm going to try and dial into, or at least watch as a recording afterwards and see what they say in terms of the integration of Chiasma. And I think what will be also interesting is something which has perhaps deterred investors in the past is that they've had quite a sort of like a messy balance sheet with expensive debt and convertible and this sort of stuff. I think once they get approval, and this is totally my guess because I haven't actually spoken to the management team, is once they get approval for oleo gel, hopefully in November, they'll then have a refinancing event and they'll replace all of that expensive stuff with, they'll either do an equity raise or put some much, much cheaper debt in there because they'll be able to, they'll buy out that. And the convertibles will convert as well. I think it's at about $2.59 at a like for like, which is roughly around about $1.85, I think. So that should convert as well. So I think it will really sort of propel the business forward, give it a much firmer financial footing, give it sufficient funds to really develop that pipeline and commercialize their oleo gel and also the Chiasma treatment for macromegalia. And, you know, basically sort out all their balance sheets. So I think they will look a totally different business. And I did notice the CEO was talking about in the conference call, you know, he's hoping to get to a $1 billion revenue business over the next, you know, few years. And I could actually,
an example. So I've had people from my Shippings Investment Club saying, Paul, I use different metrics for different companies on us for valuing companies. Like you mentioned with Tele1B, book value. Now, just explain book value if you could on Tele1B. And then how do you value this business? What are metrics you're using for this?
Okay, on the Taylor Wimpey one, with the book value, the reason why, I value it on an asset basis. And what return on capital employed? So you look at, because they're effectively, their cost of goods sold is the land they build on. They basically buy and then they build on it. So that gives you a feeling of how many years it's going to take to get back to that sort of like value. Because once they sell a house, then they're going to have to reinvest it in something equally, you know, more expensive land. Mm. So that's why it's an asset. I use an asset backing rather than a PE or a EBITDA multiple or whatever like that. And then when it comes to actually, you know, medicine, etc., just looking at peer group multiples, and this one will trade at, you know, peer group multiples can easily be, for this type of high growth business, could be 5 or 6 times sales. And, you know, they're currently trading on a less, it's about, well, about 2 point, sort of like 3 or 4 times sales, I think. And if you believe, you know, and I do, you know, my estimates for next year, so, well, next couple of years of $300 million dollars of turnover, you get to an EBITDA of roughly about 100 mil. And, you know, sort of like on a, you know, if you put a 15, 20 times EBITDA on this because it's high growth, that would not be out of, you know, out of whack either. And then you've got to sort of like risk adjust the pipeline. And I actually think Oleo Gel, given the FDA has been sponsoring it, also in light of there's no competition out there, to actually there's no existing incumbents who are going to lobby the FDA not to approve it, which happens often in America as protectionist, then I think what's the chance of not getting approved of Oleo Gel? I think it's really low. In fact, the only sort of question mark, in my view, on the 30th of November, which is why they're preparing so much, I'm sure, for the launch, is just really what label and indication the FDA is going to allow Amrit to actually, you know, to sell this product for. And I think it's going to concentrate on the 80% of the market, which is the severe cases where the efficacy is the highest. I'm sure it's going to do that. And if that's the case, then it's a huge market, and they've got orphan drug status, so they've got a patent over this and first mover advantage for years and years and years. And I think it could do really, really well. But I don't. So that's how you typically value these things. You have to put a risk adjusted on the pipeline. But I think Oleo Gel is almost a dead cert. It's going to get approved. It just is what usage the FDA are going to allow, what patient population, exact size of it is the FDA going to allow Amrit to actually to commercialize it to.
And how do you do that? When you say a risk adjusted basis, how would you do that? What do you use for that?
Well, you use it, let's say, for instance, you've got a drug in phase 1 trials, etc. Stage 1, or even preclinical, you'd give it a probability of 5%. If it gets to phase 1 or passes phase 1, it goes to 20%. Passes phase 2, maybe 50%. And then if it gets passes phase 3, probably 60%, 70%. But this has passed all of that. It's just really been rubber stamped by the FDA. And given the FDA has actually, you know, encouraged them and fast-tracked it through, then my view is that it's going to be a slam dunk. I'll be stunned if they don't.
I just talk about FDA. I'm going to say just past a month milestone for Polarium.
I know.
And I was looking at the broken note, just looking through what they say about that FDA approval. And of course, it's the difference with Polarium here. When you have, you know, drugs are the risky part, you know, of any sort of trial.
Yeah.
But I was looking at what they were saying on the broken note, and they have a 90% probability of passing this because essentially the two pivotal trials were designed and pre-agreed with the FDA, and that forms the basis for the application. And then the FDA are very comfortable with xenon gas, which is the risky part. It's a drug-device combination. And so, xenon gas is very safe for that profile. It's been used in other FDA clinics before. And also, the amount of research units are using and centers using Polarium's tech already. I mean, you've got the biggest cancer center in the US doing it. There's about 24 other centers, including University of Oxford. I don't know if you saw that, Professor Gleason there. He did a study to pick up long COVID. And the patients have been sent home that have been scanned with MRI, CT scans, and then they've used Polarium's, and they've got long COVID. They've got problems with their lungs that hasn't been picked up on MRIs. And it's in addition to the MRI scanners. So it makes MRI scanners 100,000 times image better. So it adds on to that. So if anything, part of me thinks the manufacturer is going to be doing deals with Polarium, because it just is a value add for them, because they can get more use.
The only risk I can see that the FDA doesn't approve it is not on efficacy, because that clearly works and it's a best in class, is that somebody gets to the FDA commissioners and starts lobbying against them beforehand and says, we don't want this in that market because we've got there's something else which is coming through the pipeline in the US. And it goes to that nationalistic thing, because that's happened many a time.
They are US based, though, pretty much. They are. It's really US based, pretty much. But I mean, the list.
Well, they may go underneath the umbrella then, but a lot of the time, I mean, look at Astra with its vaccines, you know, and basically it still hasn't been approved out there simply because it's not American.
But it's odd because it's a spin out from GE, but the guys, they're all based in the US. The first 100 institutions are going to install it. Yeah. They're completely focused in the US, and it's US first, then rest of the world. So
I think Polarium will get approved. There's no doubt about it.
It's phenomenal. Obviously, do you know, I saw the broker, by the way, has a huge growth based on 2% penetration of the US market. Mm. And Richard from Polarium, the CEO, is a very conservative guy generally. And when he comes to the podcast, I wanted to be a bit more promotional. And he's not, you know, he's very conservative. Come on, Richard. But he said recently on an investor call, saying, I see polarizers like this in the majority of hospitals globally within the next 10 years. Because, and I thought that's an extreme view. But I thought, hang on a sec, if it's the best tech, and it can detect these issues, nothing else can, you've got to have them. You know, you've got to have them in hospitals. You can't say, you've got something. Yeah. We don't know what it is. It's not
an immediate adoption, though, is it? That's the point. It takes a bit of time.
It's not. But I mean, they can roll it out quite quickly. And because there's an addition to MRI scanners, I think in the end, what they'll do with it.
Yeah, but you have got to train people and you have to retrofit and all that kind of stuff. So it isn't immediate. But anyway, regardless, I think it's going to get approved. And let's wait and see. The big day is what, the 5th of October, is it? I'll put that on my diary then.
Yeah. Big fan. And the other one
is Boohoo, which is quite a controversial online. You know, branded clothes retailer. And I actually spoke to CEO John Little about a couple of months ago, and I was really impressed. I mean, basically, they seem to be doing all the right things well, not only executing the strategy in terms of, you know, buying up other brands, but also growing the business. I mean, if you look at their last set of results over the last 2 years, including the pre-pandemic era, I mean, they've grown their top line by 90-odd%, which is absolutely fabulous. And what they expect to suggest this year, against really, really tough comparatives, the top line organically is going to go 20% plus. So they're executing brilliantly against the strategy. And then you've got to ask yourself, why? Why was that happening? And I just looked to where, you know, as anecdotal evidence, I look at my two daughters who both, you know, shop at, you know, things like with another brand they own, Pretty Little Thing, yeah? Yeah. And what's happened is that during the pandemic, it's taught that whole younger demographic, that younger generation, that actually they're going to buy all of their clothes online. You know, they're not going to, even when the retail parks and the shopping centres open up, then they're not going to go there to buy the clothes. Why? I might as well get them all online because I've been doing that for 15 months. It's cheaper, it's easier, it's more convenient. Mm. And that's what my two daughters are doing. So I think that pandemic has actually made a fundamental change and improvement to their business model. So if you think about it, like-for-like growth of 20%, which is actually what management are forecasting going forward, you know, over the future, is absolutely phenomenal. And these shares only trade on, if you look at next year's numbers, about 12 times EBITDA. So I could actually see, if you look at the, you know, base, I think the share price is about...
How many times?
It's about 12 times EBITDA for next year's performance. And if you look at sort of like, you know, where the share price is, it's about £2.65, yeah?
Yeah.
Then, I mean, if I look at their growth trajectory, I could easily see this business going from a £2.2 billion turnover to £5 billion over the next 5 years. And if that's the case, using a 10.5% EBITDA margin, they're currently doing just less than that at 10, but you're going to get economies of scale. If you do that and use a market multiple of what it should be, i.e. about 20 times EBITDA for this type of growth, you get to a share price of sort of like, I think it's well over, I don't remember what it was, I calculated it. It was, you get basically over £8 a share. That could be over the next 5 years. And if you use a 15 times EBITDA multiple, you get £4.80. So there's plenty of upside. And this is a 3.3 billion market cap business, so a pretty big giant. But it's doing operationally, strategically, it's doing fabulous. And to add on to their, I mean, they own all the brands, so that's great. And they just bought out of receivership people like Debenhams Online, Wallis, you know, basically, I've got Wallis, I think it is. A number of other brands they've bought, which have done brilliant, which have done well. And also what they're trying to do is actually to have be the single, the most single sort of destination for sort of like online fashion. So they'll put in things like homewares in there and cosmetics, and they may use some, well, they do, I think, in Revolution Beauty in there. So they'll be selling quite a few. And therefore, then you get this whole halo effect of the one-stop shop for that type of generation. And of course, as those people get older, they'll hopefully stay with the actual firm. So they've, mm-hmm. yeah, they've done brilliantly. They're acquiring customers really cheaply. They're fast and innovative. And that's just, that's operationally. So when I say he's doing all the right things, you can't, you just cannot fault that performance. It's fabulous. The thing that has been faulted is all the bad negative press they've had in terms of the ESG side with the supply chain, in, you know, particularly in factories out in Leicester. And he got, John Little's got one of the High Court judges, Sir Brian Leveson, to head up effectively an investigation internally and clean it all up. And he's actually done it. And this guy wouldn't put his reputation. He doesn't need the money. He's doing it because, you know, basically that's what he said. He's cleaned it up, and that's what he's actually done. So I think they've actually turned now from being sort of like somebody who's been, you know, criticised for potentially their supply chain to actually probably the gold standard on supply chain. And that will come through in due course, I'm sure. And that will,
I looked at Boohoo. I remember them dropping in the dash for cash, and I was going to grab some. And then because the lockdown happened, and their figures are better. At the time, I thought, who's buying clothes online? No one can go out. But will that affect, you know, their costs? Because their margins were better than like any other online retailers, pretty much. How are their costs so low? Won't that affect the costs if they come back into standard, you know, on an ESG level? Won't that affect their bottom line costs there?
Well, you've got a couple of things. No, you've got a couple of things to a certain extent. It's such that you've got a strengthening pound, for instance, which is obviously where the garments are actually imported and then put together. Then yes, you know, the strengthening pound will go further, so that'll help protect their margins, as most retailers. But I'm pretty sure when it comes to actually, you know, well, they've managed it already. You know, they've proved that even sort of like cleaning up the whole supply chain, their EBITDA and gross margins haven't really changed. They've only gone slightly. EBITDA has only gone slightly down because the brands they've acquired have diluted the size of it. So over the past 18 months, gross margins are still roughly around about 55%. And as after cleaning up all the supply chain. So the answer to that is, if you actually look at the evidence, no. they've managed to do it. And they haven't really pushed up prices either. So, you know, and this is, you know, sort of like highly innovative product, which is fast turnaround. So I don't think that is a major... Funny.
Yeah, do you know what's funny? You're saying the change in shopping habits. I believe that'll happen. And in fact, there's a big report out. I don't know if you saw how many shops are shutting down, chain stores, and all that.
Yeah, exactly.
And they're saying now it's a quick plug, but they're saying these places now will become entertainment centres. They won't be just completely shops, retail shops back to back. They'll be, you know, lots of restaurants, cinemas, bowling, there's go-karting, escape rooms, all that kind of stuff in one area, you know, and there'll be less retail because, I said, I've always loved buying online. My wife doesn't. And in fact, some people still go shopping physically, try things on, go online anyway, and they come home and just buy it online. So they say, I quite like that. Or they look at other shops, and they come back and compare online. So it's a mix and match as well, isn't it? It's not all online.
But also, and just to sort of sense check my apparent idiocy, but, you know, for Boohoo, I mean, you've got a really sharp investor, T. Rowe Price, who just bought 10% of Boohoo on, of somebody. And he also...
Is that your pseudonym? Is that your other name?
Well, he owns 11% of ASOS, so he knows his onions. He can see a bargain when he sees it. And the other sort of key data points, if you look at it, I wouldn't use ASOS because they don't own their brands, most of them. You know, Zabando, about 50% of their actual product they actually own. The rest of them are third party and stuff, whereas all the clothes and stuff are come through on Boohoo brands. So the best comparative, in my view, is Zalando out in Europe. And if you value them on a per customer, they're worth roughly around about £4.50 per customer, compared to sort of like Boohoo, which is, last time I calculated, was 175. So you've got a huge divergence of valuation. And I think it's only a matter of time before that closes, because I think the US is going to carry on going gangbuster. The UK is obviously doing well. And the strategy is working. It's acquiring new customers very cheaply because people like what the service that they actually get. And once the city gets comfortable that the ESG supply chain issues, which have cleaned up, and I frankly have, I've got comfortable with that whole situation now because of the actual inquiry, then I think the shares are going to do well. So these are, like, again, a long-term hold.
So, yeah, when you say that, when you get into a stock like that, Boohoo, for example, I'm looking at the chart there, and it's coming down a little bit on the trend there. But what kind of gain are you hoping to get from that? When will you decide to, you know, cash in? I mean, what do you have?
Well, as I say, my underlying value, yeah. I mean, if you just put a modest 15 times EBITDA on this, when you get £4.80, so I'd say that is a pretty conservative fair value for about sort of 3 or 4 years' time. And it could go as far as £8. There's no doubt about it. And that's largely because it's a valuation catch up against potential peers as the city become comfortable about the ESG side of it. And then it's just delivery on the actual growth. It just shows you during the pandemic, Boohoo is a super durable, high growth online brand. I mean, that's fabulous. They can get through anything this business can. Well, almost. I mean, but if you got through the pandemic, you'll do really well.
And I was doing a scan recently. During the pandemic, I was looking to go to bigger stocks, and I was scanning for, companies that have done really well the last 5-10 years and screening for them. And was it JD Sports and Boohoo were amongst those. And they'd basically done compound annual growth of above 20%, one year for like 5, 6, 7, 8 years. And it just gone up. They 10 bag pretty much. But now it's a bit of a breathe.
Yeah.
It looks like a good place to buy because they're having a bit of breathe. And that sort of, that doubt about the ESG side of it has maybe been an opportunity to some people when the CEO is obviously turning it around,
Yeah, well, I think he's actually already turned it around.
Yeah.
I mean, he announced the other day to the BBC that they were going to recruit another 5,000 people in the UK because the growth's going so well. I mean, that is just, that's fabulous for the country, never mind the actual business. And I say, I've spoken to the guy. He was very kind enough to give me about half an hour of his time, and because he's obviously a busy man. And
How did you get into you then? What happened there? How did you get in touch with him?
I just spoke to him. So that was, I obviously dropped an email to his PA, and he was very kind to give me some of his time. So I think he's a great, I think he's a really good guy, and he's just shown the execution of that business is doing all the right things very well. It's just, it's a big cap, which has got a big opportunity. You don't get that many very often. Reminds me of turning back where we were in the pandemic with a lot of big caps, had 50-100% upside in a relatively short piece of time.
At the start of this, I was going to say one of the other stocks has had a nice rally of late. It just did 20% in one day. Was it Northbridge.
Did you buy some shares? Did you get any?
I haven't got any spare cash ones locked up.
I've been talking about this one. Is the market start finally to recognise us? People may know Northbridge, basically, it's got two divisions, Crestchick, Load Banks, that is essentially being driven by things like, it does commissioning and testing of backup power supplies, and its growth is being driven by network stability issues, i.e. networks going down, renewable energy at data centers, all these long-term secular growths. And it's going like a train, and having to actually increase capacity by 50%, which should come on stream next year. So there's that, and then they're selling there's an ongoing disposal process for Tasman. But I've been talking about this as over a £2.
What was the catalyst? There's no news on that rise.
There was. I was just coming to it, and I've been saying, I've been banging the table, this is worth £2 plus anyway. last week, Investors Chronicle stock picker Simon Thompson recommended it to his investors, and that moved the share price up from about 125 up to about 150 today. So people are just starting to recognise the potential upside. And when I do a sum of the parts, I get a very, you know, this is a conservative estimate, I get easily a £2.05, you know, share price for the business. And they've got their interim results at the end of September, where I'm hoping to hear an update on the actual disposal. Interestingly, Baker Hughes, I mean, basically what Tasman do, it's a much smaller business. As I say, they've had approaches that people want to buy this business. What it basically does is it rents out drilling tools, largely for gas and geothermal, down in Australasia. And as you people probably know, the gas price, natural gas and LNG price, has really increased globally, never mind down in Asia Pacific. So that's been helping the whole sort of dynamic of that particular industry. And on the latest rig count news from Baker Hughes, which came out last week, there's been a significant tick up in the number of rigs, this drilling rigs, in Australasia, which is absolutely their most important market. So that could hopefully help that whole process complete. But we'll wait and see anyway. I think it's a win-win situation. If they don't get the offer that they want, they'll keep it and they'll sell it next year. And if they do, that's great. It'll simplify the actual group, and they'll be able to concentrate on Crestcheek. So I'm happy either way with what they decide. I trust the management team. But I think this could get well above £2. In fact, once they sell Tasman, I could see this business growing at 10-15% per annum. And if that's the case, with EBITDA drop-through rates on its rental of load banks of 80% plus, return on capital employed of over 20%, and it's super cash generative, I could see this business not, you know, in 3 or 4 years' time, this is a share price going up above £3 or £4 easily. So I'm happy to hold it. It's a large position now, actually. I want to keep it. Two others now, which have gone up quite large for me, are Alico, which is coming out with its results next week. And as that's done really well, really, for two reasons. One is because of all the supply chain disruption in the house building sector, because it does project planning software for it. Because all the house building and infrastructure disruption with getting products, getting people, getting HGV drivers, actually, there's now even massive, massive demand for really good, best-in-class software to do that, to help the project planners at the hard, sharp end really make sure they deliver on time and manage all the bottlenecks and manage all the products and the services which go on their critical path. So that is just, I'm sure that's done really well in the first half. And then the other side of the coin is that they've got an AI visualization tool that sells soft furnishings and floorings and stuff like Cardine. And that one again is, you know, and I want to use the pun, that's gone, must have gone through the roof. And the reason why I say that is that because people like the flooring guys, they haven't been able to have their showrooms open. People want to have a look at, you know, online to see, to buy it and to size it up and to see how it looks into their room. Their software's great. And my wife has just bought some carpets, and she used Cardine's software, which is powered by Alico, and that's gone fabulous. So I'm pretty there's no reason why I would touch Alico. We'll wait and see what the results are next week, but I suspect they're pretty good. So that one's done well.
What happens if just based on value, or if a company does so well that it takes up a big chunk of your portfolio, would you just, you know, cut a few there?
That's a good question, but at the moment they're still not overvalued. And they may get a point in time when it becomes an oversized position. It's currently roughly around about 16-17% of my portfolio, which is getting quite a lot. But I trust the management team. They seem to be doing a great job. And they're still not, I mean, the industry, their peers, these companies go for 6-7 times sales, and they're currently trading up roughly around about sort of 3-4 times sales. So they're still not expensive in that respect. And the opportunity set globally is enormous for it. So I think there's plenty of upside. And the other one, which I've been banging the table on, I did say the two best, the start of the year, you know, I said to you, my two best ideas for small caps are Northbridge, which is now doing really well, and Equals. And again, they've got their interims coming out next week, and I think they're going to put out some good numbers. All their peers are putting out good numbers. And at the trading update back in July, CEO Ian Strafford-Taylor, you know, said to me that, you know, the business, well, he told to everybody in the announcement that, you know, the business had done very well, particularly in June. And he gave that split between the B2B side and the travel side. And the travel side will come back at some point in time, particularly if we get a blockbuster COVID therapeutic, which I think we'll get from either Merck or Roche later this year. And if that's the case, then international travel is going to be well on everybody's sort of like crosshairs for next year, which will obviously, you know, boost these guys. So, and the shares have responded well. They're about 55, so they're quite a big position now as well. So I'm delighted. I mean, I said to you last year, I had a disastrous 2021, or, you know, it wasn't my finest hour, but I expected disastrous 2020. Now I expect the 2021 to be pretty good. And that's really how it's sort of transferred out. But these can change very quickly. And so,
my end of 2020 was very good. Start of 2021 was very good until 4 months, pretty much. But just in the second quarter, it's okay. But since the middle of the second quarter, it's been hard work, you know, bloody hard work. And just going sideways or grinding a bit lower sideways. And every day is boring. You know, in fact, I went on holidays to Portugal and the stocks get, you know, you saw signs, all your stocks are down. And, you know, and they think, oh, it's one of those, you know, I mean, the seasonality of where liquidity is drying up and there's worries about inflation. Yeah. And it's all, and that happened for like days and days. And then all of a sudden, it broke a little bit and started seeing green in the portfolio. But since then, it's gone sideways. And saying, God, this is frustrating. September's just started now. And I thought we'd see a bit more movement. But it's still just grinding sideways or down or up a little bit, going nowhere, you know? Like, come on!
Yeah.
It's so frustrating, is it? But that's what I say. I have a problem with patience anyway. Mm. But when I'm holding five stocks, I believe in, you know, and I want to hold for a while. But I just want to see some movement. But I believe as we get towards the end of the year, it'll probably ease up a little bit. But it's been hard. I'd say, 3 months, maybe? Yeah, two and a half, 3 months. So, yeah. So,
I had a hard last year. So, you know, I mean, things move forward, things move back. And that's the way it is to a certain extent. We both go for sort of, you know, conviction plays, large positions, and that carries idiosyncratic risk. And yes, things move up quickly, but they can move down quickly as well. And you just got to readjust your portfolio or readjust, you know, your sort of investment thesis and time horizons accordingly. But
I tell you what I like. Yeah, no, exactly. So I was chatting to you know these guys today, Lung Life AI.
Oh yes,
and I really like
Paul Pagano and their system. And David Anderson.
Yeah, I chatted them today.
How did you get on with them?
Excellent. Well, the tech is amazing. I'm going to spare cash, yes. But it's still early stage yet. But I mean, they're heading in the right direction. They've got cash, and a huge area, lung cancer. But if you look at their tech there, it's called Lung LB test. Of course, they draw some blood, and there's biomarkers in the blood using AI tech. And
it's concentrated, just the important bit, it's concentrating on circulating tumor cells, which are really quite rare. But they give you an excellent bio footprint of whether somebody has got cancer, particularly in this case, lung cancer or early stage lung cancer. And just to fill in the blanks on that one, the standard of care at the moment for early stage lung cancer is a CT test. And a CT test has only got an accuracy of about 60% because 40% are just false positives. This one has got an accuracy, I think it was 89%.
Yeah, I know the positive predictive value of 89%.
And because of the AI and because they're doing that validation test, that accuracy is going to get better as they do more of that work and build the biobank. So this could get really to be best in class. Anyway, sorry, I thought I'd just add that to you.
No, it's exactly as I asked Paul, I said, so, you know, is it 80% of people, who discovered that lung cancer discovered in stage four? And he said, basically, that stage is too late. You know, all you're doing is managing.
Survival rates are really low, aren't they?
Yeah, and he said, and this can potentially pick it up in stage one, where you can actually cure it and deal with it, and that 90% or 89% success rate so far. And like I said, still early stage, you know, but they've got cash and they've got some big
milestones. I've done a hypothetical valuation because this is a big market, you know.
Yeah,
and I reckon just from other people, sort of like in their communications, this is like a $2.9 billion market, and if they win ultimately after, I think the commercialization, they're trying to launch sometime, they're on the timeline, on track to do that in 2023. If ultimately they get a 5% market share of that, you could easily see this, the share price, 20 quid, just, and that would be just in line or even less in line, you know, still cheap compared to actual peers, because this could be an absolute game changer for the whole industry. And the shares are currently just south of £2. So there's masses of upside in this. And I think the key milestones over the next 2 years, as I understand it, is to complete this validation study. Once that's done, get FDA approval, then get insurance coverage, and then actually launch it. And yes, they're going to, and they're fully funded to be able to do that. So that's not a problem. And along that way, they're going to basically continue to improve the whole accuracy and that AI and the speed of actually doing this test. So I think there's a lot of value creation points, a lot of catalysts over the next 2 years. But investors have just got to be prepared that that's the sort of timeline, because regulatory authorities don't move that, you know, they move glacially, not sort of like at light speed.
No, that's exactly it. I'm just thinking, you know, you could invest now, and it could, you know, like I said, even if the general market sell-off, it could come lower, because, like I said, they've got a while until they get to that commercialization point. But nevertheless, you know, who knows? These kind of stocks can trade well ahead, can't they, of a commercialization, when you see the potential, the size of the market that they're addressing is very big, like you say.
And but, it's another example of sort of like, you know, Amrit, etc. Like there's a huge unmet need, and you know, basically the standard of care is rubbish. So you have to have something that is actually, you know, doesn't have to be that much better, but because there's nothing out there to be able to do. So, you know, it's absolutely perfect. And what I also like about the whole medicine, we've talked about it, is the pricing power of it. So if we do get inflation, then these guys can push prices through. It's very easy to do that. You know, it's justified. So, you know, it gives you that whole, you know, inflation hedge.
Yeah.
Another healthcare which came out with numbers was Bellascura, and I know we've talked about these guys before, but they do portable oxygen concentrators, and they have this enrichment technology that is used to treat sort of people with severe respiratory conditions. So things like COPD and all the, you know, basically other types of severe conditions, even sort of COVID, etc. And what's happening is that the regulatory authorities are not only seeing the benefits of having portable rather than static oxygen supply to actual patients, i.e. they can then treat themselves at home, but so it frees up their, you know, basically their resources, but also the actual patient outcomes is better from mentally and actually from treatment. So these whole portable oxygen concentrators are actually getting more therapeutic areas pushed their way. Going forward, so it's a bigger market. And what was quite interesting is that the management team are I think there's some research which has come out, they're upgrading the growth prospects for portable oxygen concentrators to 14%, you know, per annum over the next 5 years. And again, if you run the sort of numbers and these guys get sort of like, you know, I think it was like 5% of this particular market. I can't remember how much I was actually, I'm just going to see how much, but I was getting, what was it compared to the share? That's right. Yeah. The shares they listed was at 45p. They're currently trading at just south of a pound. I'm getting a fair value just on that sort of like 12 to 14 times EBITDA multiple of roughly around about £2. So you still got a lot of upside there. And the demand, what's really interesting, the demand for these products is already getting really strong. And their order flow, the hard bit is actually going to be sourcing all the parts and getting all the manufacturers to meet these particular orders. And they seem to be doing a very good job. They've appointed 4 distributors so far, and they've shipped their first product. So things are moving along pretty well. And they're fully cashed up.
When you see that, because I've always thought of that, when you see big markets, the potential, because I did ask, you know, David from Long Life, I said, so what's the potential here? It seems quite blue sky here from where we are. And he did say, like you said, around about 3 billion is their target mark. So and you said 2.9, so spot on there. So when you're looking at that and you're saying what potentially was share of that market they can get, how do you know what figures to look at? Because you just said 5% there a couple of times. Is that a conservative look at?
It is. That is very conservative, because if it becomes a best in class treatment, then you tend to get a lot more than that very quickly. But let's just assume there's other competitors who we can't see come through, et cetera, and there's two delays. And if you, as I say, if you don't put racy value, don't put racy expectations in there, only 5%, you still get a huge benefit on the actual share price. So it builds up a very big sort of safety, you know, safety margin into your expectations and valuation. I mean, who knows how big these would get to? But you can just see how, if the scenario pans out as the, you know, the management teams think it will, then you can see the potential upside for shareholders, as long as you're prepared to, you know, hold for a reasonable long time and see it go through. I mean, what will frankly happen? Yeah, it's going to be like Plarium, isn't it? You get approval, you start getting, you know, you start tapping, it's commercializing, and then a big guy comes along and puts in a huge price and buys you off the market, don't they? That's simply what happens, which is a shame, because you don't see the whole sort of, like, you know, gestation of that development. But
it's better making a loss.
but you get a big price premium and a big price tick up quite quickly. So which is cool. Pretty
good. Any more?
Well, there's the Michelmersh. They came out with interims. Which is the,
I heard, I did hear Paul say, it's a funny way, Michelmersh, isn't it? And one of the guys said, Michael Marsh. And I said, Michael Marsh? And he was having a joke on the name. I thought, oh, yeah, yeah. Michelmersh. Okay. Yeah, so bricks. So what's the deal there?
It's premium bricks, yeah?
Yeah.
And they've had an unbelievably strong first quarter. They are, I mean, compared to the housing market and the general sort of building products industry. The building products industry is still slightly below where it was pre-pandemic levels. These guys are 10% above in the first half in revenues and PBT than they were at that time in 2019. So they're really knocking the ball out of the park. They can sell all the bricks that they manufacture. The hard bit is obviously managing the supply chain in terms of their costs and also getting more capacity on. But they've done this in the past in terms of, you know, sort of like bringing on new capacity, and they're looking to debottleneck some of their, you know, facilities and increase the throughput of it. So they're turning all the stones on that one. And there's also M&A, because they're generating so much cash. Anyway, they put a fairly conservative outlook. They upgraded their expectations for the year, but I still think they're very conservative out there. I think there's a chance that they could be. I don't know. We'll wait and see. And they're doing a great job, and the shares have sold off. Actually, they went up originally straight away on the at the gate, but have come off a bit, and that's just largely because the whole building products and house building in the ecosystem has also sold off over the last few days, largely because of global growth concerns, supply chain concerns, and also the tax that the government have put onto it. So you know, you can understand what's happening, but I think when I run the actual numbers, I mean, the shares have threefolded over the last, you know, near 5 years since the start of 2027. I could see these shares doubling over the next 5 years as well. Mm. And that wouldn't be a racy valuation to go to sort of like, you know, £2.70 or something like that for £1.40 currently. So it's a high quality business run by a good management team that have effectively got, it's a trophy asset, because you can't get these premium bricks. They really are sort of like, you know, hardly anybody else does them. You get a few imports they compete against, and you get a few sort of like other, the big boys may do some of these premium bricks. But essentially, you know, the aesthetics and the build quality of these things is unique. So, and what's important is that not only, they've got about a 50-50 split between new build housing and RMI, i.e. repairs, maintenance, and that's going really, really well, obviously. But also there's a whole trend towards premium houses, and people want to buy a bigger house, want a newer house that looks good. And then you've got all the infrastructure happening as well. So you've got things like HS2 wants good quality bricks for their new flagship railway stations, for instance. And you've got redeveloping of all the high streets and you know, retail outlets and all this sort of stuff, and the offices, which will have to happen. Plus, you've got then the recladding to go for. They're using brick systems and stuff. So you've got so many different growth. It's not a demand problem. The demand is absolutely just racing ahead. The hard bit is actually going to be getting supply as fast as they can to be able to, you know, satisfy the actual demand. So it's a beautiful position that they're in. And it's been run really, really well, generating a lot of cash. So again, I would say, if you're looking for a secular growing sort of like, you know, stock, small cap that, you know, has delivered in the past and is very likely to deliver going forward, then Michaelmas is probably the one to go for, because you won't go too far wrong.
Okay, let me any more stocks? I'll ask you two quick macro.
That's about it. Those are the ones
okay.
I...
Okay, two things. What's your thoughts on the national insurance raise?
I personally am absolutely delighted that we're starting to raise taxes on people to pay for the NHS. I think it's a long time coming. I think we should have done it ages ago for social care. In terms of where it goes and who it hits and stuff, I haven't really got much of a view. I don't really mind. I mean, I'll have to pay it. You'll have to pay it. Everybody will have to pay it. And I'll pay it. I've really got no problem with that. But I can understand this whole thing, you know, that people are saying that should it go for the people it's benefiting more? But I mean, I'm just glad we're raising it, and we're going to. I think we need to raise a lot more. My view. What about you? What's your view?
Yeah. No. Do you know what? Again, there's a lot of it is politics. You know, a lot of people shouting about this, about breaking the manifesto pledge. I did think that was a good line from Boris saying, you know, that the pandemic wasn't in the manifesto.
Yeah.
They did have problems with the NHS before that, but yeah, it's much needed. And again, it's hard to say where you need to get a lot of money. And, you know, people saying you tax the rich, but you won't get a lot of money if you just up the rich. You need numbers of people, loads of people paying in. So NI seems like, I don't know.
It's a start, and I think we'll have more taxes going forward. And frankly, if I can see a one-to-one match that it's going to people that we actually do need, people in poor health and stuff like that, that actually need treatment to get rid of the sort of like, I'm absolutely delighted. In fact, I'll be happy to pay even more.
Yeah, and I want to see the part of this go towards wages. I want to see the NHS attract, you know, quality staff. That's what we want, and people actually getting paid good money for doing a very good job, you know. And that's what we want, is a world leader like that. That's what it should be like. But and one other thing on macro supply chain problems, all that sort of HGV. I don't know if you saw today. I think it is today actually. They're now reducing the HGV test. A driver test application, so it'll take you less time to pass your test.
So you're going to do that as well then? You're going to drive one of these great big 10-ton trucks?
I've heard loads of people say, some people apparently, a friend of mine said, there are now some lorry drivers are earning more than solicitors, and so they're just jumping in there. And so they're basically saying, if you've got arms and legs and you can see through your eyeballs, you can drive. You get it, you know, get it. I mean, that's good that they've done that, but I mean, do you see this? I mean, there's been a lot of talk now of supply chain problems. It's going to be around for a while. In fact, oddly as well, I don't know how this has affected. My father runs a car sales. He said he was off for a couple of days of COVID last week, but his son who works there, my brother, said, if we sell the amount of cars we sell last month to this month, Dad, we'll have hardly any stock left and we can't buy any. Buying stock is really hard at the moment. And he said he's got auctions. There's nothing around. And of course, what's going to happen is if you go to an auction, there's one decent car there and you've got all these traders bidding it up, it's going to get more expensive, isn't it? So you've got supply chain issues and you've got this kind of thing. But you mentioned before, people said about transitory inflation. It's going to be around for a bit longer, isn't it, than we think? Absolutely. Yeah.
I think you need to be in stocks with pricing power.
Pricing power,
I would say there's two things, okay? Once the furlough scheme ends at the end of this month, there's going to be at least 900,000 people who are going to be looking for jobs and wanting to work. And there's roughly around about 950,000 vacancies in the UK. Now, you won't be able to get that perfect. You won't be able to get that perfect match, but you'll be able to alleviate some of those issues, particularly for Christmas, which is great. And a similar sort of thing is happening in the States. So that's good, right? But actually, this has got a massive silver lining, okay? And then people say, why is that, Paul? You're on a different planet, mate. Well, the reason why is next year, the world is going to have a massive restocking of all the inventories levels and supply chains that it's had to dwindle down. And that's going to add on a massive boost to GDP globally everywhere. And also you're going to get a reshoring as well in places like the UK. So I actually think that's going to be a big tailwind next year and should not be discounted in valuation. So there's two reasons why I am macro really bullish about the stock market. Okay, one is you're going to get that, even in the headwinds of taxes go up, i.e. the re-inventorying, restocking of all that. As far cars, for instance, as you talked about, building products, chips, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, silicon chips, not your chips down your fish and chip. And then the other one is, as I mentioned to before, there is going to be, in my view, a blockbuster therapeutic coming forward in the next 6 months. Once that happens, we will then have the actual gold, the three golden blockbusters. We'll have superb COVID testing. We've got superb vaccines with boosters. And for those people who haven't got the immune system to actually create antibodies from the vaccines to protect them, we will then have effectively the drugs, the antivirals, which will be able to help those guys before they get in hospital and when they're actually in hospital themselves. And that's what I'm very positive in terms of Merck and Roche's phase three trials. And there's been some big option buying in Merck already ahead of the news release on that one in the US. So my view is that somebody already knows what's happening in the clinical trials and thinks it's going to come out with some good results. And you've also got another one, which is the next generation Remdesivir from Gilead as well, which is coming through, which will be able to take orally rather than intravenously, which again will be able to, you'll be able to do that before you have to go into hospital. So if we get those three legs together, great testing, blockbuster vaccines with the booster shots and therapeutics, we're there basically. We're absolutely there. You're going to see huge pent-up demand for international travel next year. Fab. For everybody.
A whole lot of stuff. Yeah. Cool. Thanks, Paul. Listen, next week, remind me, I want to bring up what you think about the American market valuations at the moment, because there's a couple of bears out there saying this is now, we're stretched beyond.
Well, I'll tell you what, I know we normally do it fortnightly. We should do this next week because there's some big news. Some big news in terms of, Alico and a bunch of other stocks which we need to, and we'll do that. So we'll chuck that in the diary and we'll do a special for next week.
Marvellous. And if you wanted to inbox, don't forget, hit that subscribe button, notification bell, if you obviously want it on video, and listen on the podcast. Cheers, Paul. Speak next week.
Yeah, thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.